Welcome to the Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the Political Cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Welcome, everyone, to another installment of the Political Cesspool Radio Program. I'm your host, James Edwards, coming to you once again from Memphis, Tennessee, this Saturday evening, May 16th, 2009. And joining me in the studio, Bill Rowland. Bill, are you on the line? No Bill yet, apparently. Working through some technical difficulties again here, and that happens from time to time when you are a live and uncensored radio program like the Political Cesspool is. Well, welcome to the show, everyone. It's been a busy week here in the cesspool. I guess it always is. In fact, every week we continue to stand the test of time. I continue to amaze and mesmerize myself a little bit more. And upon reflection, you know, this program has been delivering the kind of uncensored radio commentary that no other show in America is doing every week for the past nearly 5 years. Over 4.5 years now we've been here on the air. And there hasn't been a week that's passed since October of 2004 that the Political Cesspool has not been broadcast on AM stations across the country. And, of course, that's something we're very proud of. Now, tonight's program, we're not going to have a featured guest this evening, although we do have some great guests and some great shows forthcoming throughout the month of May. And really, for continuing all the way through the end of the summer, for that matter. But tonight, however, no guest planned. Bill and I will be covering the headlines for the past week and past few days, as we always do. And we will be going behind enemy lines with Keith Alexander. Of course, that's a segment that we've begun infusing into the program during the first hour of each week. And Keith is going to be bringing us part two of his continuing dissection of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Of course, that was May 17th, 1954, when America got turned on its head. And I guess this would be the conclusion to that series, which started last week as we go behind enemy lines with Keith Alexander in just a few moments' time. Bill, are you in yet?
I just crawled up through the manhole.
There he is. There he is. Well, you know, he was down there with our brothers in the Hundley, and he finally found the hatch, I guess.
I'm back now. I just came up through the manhole, out of the cesspool, and back into the cesspool. So
well,
here I am.
Well, we live in the cesspool. You know, it's a dirty job. It's a dangerous job. You know, we live our life in the trenches, and sometimes it's hard to find the surface and get out of the front lines, go back to the command headquarters, get on the radio. You know, we got to do it all here. We're not just on the radio. We're out in the gutters too. God knows. Bill, how you doing?
We ought to be on that. I'm doing great. We ought to be on that show, Dirty Jobs, because we have to handle politics, and that's the dirtiest job there is.
Well, yeah, Mike Rowe, yeah, he hadn't seen a dirty job yet, that guy. He needs to come do a story on us, I'll tell you what. But and there's a lot of stuff going on this week that is certainly providing worthy content for this program, and we're going to be getting to some of that. I guess we do have a lot of serious stuff to cover tonight, as we always do. We have to, provide a continuing mix of the bitter with the better. Obviously, Keith Alexander is going to be on in a couple of moments' time to, you know, give us a little more education on a very serious matter, one that certainly was a tumultuous day in American history. And then in the second and third hour, we're going to continue on covering the headlines. But one thing I want to do, Bill, just to start things off on the lighter side this evening, did you read the story about the bar in Connecticut that was forced basically to remove this cardboard cutout of Barack Obama that, you know, was a tongue-in-cheek sort of a mockery like every president is subjected to. But, of course, Barack Obama being a black president, he is not to be subjected to such ridicule, lest it be hate speech and thought crimes and, you know, punishable by death and so on and so forth. But you can't make fun of this president. That's the bottom line. Free speech continues to die a slow death here in America because the feelings of Jews, blacks, Mexicans, and homosexuals are more important than the freedom to think and say what you want. Diversity and free speech cannot coexist. And here's the scoop. A Connecticut bar owner has taken down a quote-unquote pimped-out cardboard cutout of Barack Obama, complete with gold teeth and a pink hat, after complaints by the state NAACP. Very quickly, Bob Servino owns the Side Street Grill in Hamden, Connecticut. He says the cutout, accessorized by customers and employees, was simply a joke and not, quote-unquote, racist. He defends his right to display it, but he did take it down on Tuesday because the NAACP threatened to picket the bar, and he said, quote, it wasn't worth the headache. Bill, I mean, seriously, not as if the NAACP was ever a worthy organization. I mean, we all know it wasn't even founded or created by blacks to begin with. But is this, they've got nothing better to do than this. I mean, this is something that warrants their attention. I mean, neither you or I like George Bush, but he was subjected to constant ridicule, comparing him to monkeys and everything else. And that was funny to the media. But by God, this isn't.
The point here is that free speech and your right to express yourself, even on your own property, in your own business, you don't have that right anymore. And the NAACP takes advantage of these situations. They exploit these situations so that they can get publicity and so they can continue the impression that they have power over ordinary people, over ordinary white people. And so I really regret that the bar owner caved in so suddenly. He should have at least objected and said, this is my bar. Everyone in here is welcome. I'm forced by law to serve anyone, but I will not give up my right to, decorate this bar any way that I see fit. So I really blame the bar owner, and he's really just symptomatic of the lack of will among, particularly among white people, to stand up for their rights of free speech. You know, because he's getting a headache over this, that's sufficient for him just to cave in to the NAACP. And, what kind of publicity does he get? Does he really think that the NAACP is going to stop harassing him now because he's caved in? I don't think so. You'll be hearing more about this. Probably this bar owner has been forced to close his doors because black patrons coming in have, not paid their bill or have objected, and they'll find some other reason to give this man far more headaches than he got from just that poster.
And, of course, there never would have been a white organization. Well, I guess, first of all, because other than the Council of Conservative Citizens and European Americans United and maybe a couple of others, there are no organizations out there that – whose expressed interest is to protect and defend the cultural heritage of European Americans. But, you know, never would it have been a problem if they had been ridiculing, some sort of a white leader on a cardboard cutout. Of course, then again, you have to think hard. I mean, who would you consider to be a white leader there, Bill? Who of us could have a cardboard cutout to begin with? I mean, when you think of national leaders that are standing up vigorously, and I'm not saying Barack Obama is one of these people for blacks, because, I mean, let's face it, he's just a puppet. But nevertheless, and this is a little bit of a spinoff on the topic at hand, but who would you say, Bill, is a real leader for white Americans right now in this day and age?
The entire Republican Party is a cardboard cutout. The most significant representative of cardboard cutouts in the Republican Party, I would say, would be Mitt Romney. But there are no, all of these, the Republican leadership has turned into cardboard cutouts. One of them, of course, being a black cutout himself with Michael Steele. But there isn't any leadership. And this has been the outcome of the failure of our people to select leadership. We have not selected leadership. We have selected conventional politicians who we believe will go to Washington and do half a job. We don't pick people to go and do the full job. Let's take, for instance, the congressman here in the 9th District of Tennessee, Steve Cohen. Now, he was elected in a predominantly black district. He bends over backwards to prove himself worthy, not to his white constituency, but to his black constituency. He bends over backwards to try to please and accommodate the blacks who put him into office. What politician do we have that would do that? The minute
exactly.
We elect somebody.
That's the point, Bill, and that's what I think one of the reasons this show is in existence, to fight for such representation. Because don't we deserve it? I mean, doesn't the majority deserve a voice? No one, including this very program, has ever said the minorities are not entitled to a voice. But shouldn't we be entitled to some representation? Shouldn't we be entitled to true equality, where people are selected for jobs based upon merit and not the fulfillment of some sort of a quota? I mean, that's what we're fighting for, and no one has the courage to stand up for a notion that simple. We're not asking for special treatment like everyone else. We just want to be treated fairly. And no one's standing up and touting such a line, because it's racist to say that there should be true equality.
Well, there's no such thing as true equality, and I do want to be treated specially. I want to be treated specially by the people that I vote for and that I support in government.
Well, we'll be back with more right after that. Stay tuned, everybody.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool Guys will be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please don't understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand me, baby.
Don't let me be.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
And we are back on the air, everyone. We have temporarily lost James to the apparently he is between the airwaves right now, but we're back on the air. And I believe we have our friend and occasional co-host, Keith Alexander, on the air. Keith,
welcome,
are you there?
Welcome back to the Political Cesspool, everyone. James Edwards here with you on AM 1380 WLRM Radio, our flagship station from Memphis, Tennessee, broadcasting to our affiliate stations, courtesy of the Liberty News Radio Network. And, of course, going out all over the world on the Internet at thepoliticalcesspool.org. Continuing now, we're going to go behind enemy lines about 15 minutes early this evening because our political cesspool correspondent, Keith Alexander, requested the additional time this evening to conclude his two-part series on the abomination that is the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education decision. That was, of course, the Supreme Court ruling that came to a head on May 17th, 1954. That anniversary is tomorrow. Now, Keith, I ask you again. Now, we did a very good segment last week for a half hour. Why is it so important that we spend such a great amount of time on this program over the course of 2 weeks letting people know all of the inner workings of Brown versus Board and the tremendously detrimental effect that it has played on our country?
Well, James and Bill, tomorrow is the 55th anniversary of what is probably the most significant decision ever rendered by the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's the Brown decision. The Brown decision was important far beyond the issue that it dealt with, which was school desegregation in public schools. It's significant because it was basically the turning point in American history when liberalism gained traction in America. And when liberals learned how to govern America through the courts without winning elections or persuading legislators. Everything that has transpired since then, the liberal transformation of America, would not have been possible without the Brown decision.
Well, Keith, let me ask you this. Let's look at America on this date, May 16, 1954. All right, let's go back to 1954, 55 years ago today. What did America look like then compared to what it looks like now, and how did Brown actually play a physical role in that degeneration?
Well, let's take a look at what America looked like on May the 16th of 1954. It's basically been a downhill slide consistently ever since then. America had just won World War II and was the most prosperous nation. It had the highest GDP, gross domestic product, of any other of any nation in the world. We had the freest people. We had the most satisfied people. We had an industrial base. We had the highest wages, and basically we were the dominant cultural power in the world, and it was a cultural power that was for the most part very good. If you look at movies that predated May 16th, 1954, things like Shane, things like On the Waterfront, and High Noon, all of these exemplified a restrained Christian worldview. For example, in the movie Shane was basically a Christ figure. He was like a Sir Galahad. There was no we had no sexual depravity that was officially sanctioned. We had 90% of America was of European origin at that time, and everything that has happened to America to weaken it and to reduce our quality of life has occurred because of liberalism, which was ushered in through the Brown decision.
So in that way, obviously, you know, it would be a stretch to say that Brown was the single biggest reason for what I think, Keith and Bill, is perhaps one of the greatest downfalls in the history of recorded civilization. But you would say, Keith, it would be quite obvious to say that Brown did play more than just a passing footnote.
It was a camel's nose in the tent, gentlemen. It was really the rifle shot that started the avalanche. And if, you know, liberals had been around before Brown, and they were working their way into the institutions of the United States, like the Supreme Court, like the federal government, like the movie industry, like the news media, people like Walter Lippmann, for example. And they were getting their toehold, but they really had not had a significant victory, a victory that really changed the lives of ordinary Americans until the Brown decision.
But, you know, when you think back...
So I really don't think you can overestimate its importance, James.
You know, I'm 28 years old. My father was alive and well in 1954. It wasn't that long ago. It wasn't that long ago, but that seems like an alternate universe when you think of how healthy America was back then compared to this Orwellian world we find ourselves living in now. Many people who were there when Brown was written are still here. Bill, I mean, would you agree that this decision was that paramount in America's downfall? And, you know, even today, liberals don't even crow about it anymore. I guess they're beyond that now. What is the importance of us bringing this to the public's attention?
Well, I certainly think it's always worthwhile to bring people back to reality and some historical realities. How much good it does in terms of convincing people how far down we have fallen from our position in 1954 is questionable. But let's take a look. Right now, there's actually a Miss California USA who is being raked over pins, needles, and broken glass over the fact that she has defended traditional marriage. Now, who would have thought that in 1954?
I think that cuts right to the bone with surgical-like precision. I mean, there you go. I mean, we often publicize the amount of torture that we receive from the media, but in comparison to what Miss California is going through for saying something so simple, it's like she got her head cut off and we got to pull out splinters from time to time. I mean, this is, I couldn't draw a better comparison. So.
Well, what happened to her basically is that she lost the Miss USA pageant because she expressed views that would be, basically are still commonplace in America and would have been beyond question. Can you imagine anyone in 1954 imagining the idea that there would be a big public brouhaha about gay marriage and that the proponents of gay marriage would be winning? And the reason they're winning is because of the template, the blueprint that was established by the left in the Brown decision. When they could not get their way through the legislature or through the executive, they resorted to the courts. That's what they did in Brown, and that's what they're still doing today on the gay marriage issue. They whenever the people of a particular state change their constitution, go to the time, trouble,
yes,
and expense to change their constitution to outlaw gay marriage, liberals run to the federal court system to get the legislative action or the constitutional amendment overturned by saying that it is contrary to the U.S. Constitution. And unfortunately, they still win using that same old template from Brown.
Well, you know, Keith, it's interesting, and Bill also, and of course everyone listening, Brown versus Board of Education, in case anyone doesn't know, and I would find it hard to believe that you don't, this was, of course, the decision that ushered in forced integration across America. That's where it all began. And then now, once again, every state that has had so-called gay marriage on the ballot has voted overwhelmingly against it. They have even, as you said, Keith, changed the Constitution to reaffirm marriage as an institution between a man and a woman. But yet still, even California, as left-wing as it is, has enough conservatism left to vote down gay marriage as they did in Proposition 8 last year. But with all of that being the fact, the number of states with legalized sodomite marriage is 5 and rapidly climbing. And again, I agree with you wholeheartedly, Keith. The reason they were able to do this is because of the footprint from Brown. We'll be back with more right after this.
Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool, call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place.
Yes. Hello? Are we on the air? Okay, we're back on the air, everybody, and welcome back to the Political Cesspool Radio Show. James, are you with us?
I'm back, I guess.
Well, a few little slight sparks and loose wires there, but we're back on the air. And is Keith still with us?
I can hear you, but it sounds like a...
I've been cut off. Hey, can somebody get me on there?
Keith!
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, where were we? Before the break, we were talking about Brown versus the Board of Education. And I don't know whether James is on the line with us right now. We're having a few technical difficulties, but we will proceed. As far as Brown versus the Board of Education goes, what about the subsequent really barrage of lawsuits that came up following Brown that have to do with discrimination? I mean, clearly they relied on Brown to for success. I mean, for at least the expectation of success.
Well, yeah, that's why I say that Brown is so important. Brown is really the point where the dam broke. Liberalism gained traction in America. And everything that's happened, for example, I was saying that back in May of 1954, people of European descent made up 90% of the population of the United States, which meant that only 10% were non-white. And part of liberalism's, destructive program towards traditional America has been to open up the floodgates of immigration from the third world. The Immigration Act of 1965 was another part of it, and all of this came from liberalism. I think it's important for our viewers to hear this because there are people abroad and about now in the blogosphere and in the media generally that say that the distinction between conservatism and liberalism is somehow outmoded or outdated. Look at everything that has been a liberally corrosive program directed at traditionalism in America. The sexual revolution, the drug culture, school integration, homosexual rights, radical feminism, criminal rights, black rights. None of these things were the brainchild of the John Birch Society or any other conservative group. All of this came from the political left. And the political left's great moment of triumph that changed everything was the Brown decision. I think that people on the right and left need to be very clear about that. That's the point. That's, like the movie they had in the 50s, The Day the Earth Stood Still. May 17th, 1954 was the day that the earth stood still and suddenly, everything changes. It's been in a process of flux and change ever since, and we haven't hit bottom yet.
Well, and I mean, what is bottom? I mean, in terms of the use of the courts, let's say activist courts, activist judges, rendering these decisions based on the perception of social justice, where does it end? I mean, obviously, any state constitution could be overthrown in court, and couldn't, for instance, homosexual marriage be forced on all the states by the same method?
Well, certainly. Just in exactly the same way that racial integration or school integration was enforced upon public schools. You know, there's nothing that apparently holds these things back now. They've discovered the template. They've discovered the philosopher's stone. They've discovered the method to enforce a minority viewpoint, which liberalism still is in America, as this gay marriage debate shows. They've got this contra-majoritarian methodology in place that they've proven to be successful, and they can just crank up the machine and basically force anything on us. And I think what you asked where it will end, I think it will end in the persecution of the founding stock of America. I think it's going to happen exactly like Franz Fanon, the black revolutionary from France, said in one of his famous quotations. He said that the true wish of the slave is not to be free, but rather that he and his slave master exchange places. And I think that's where it's headed, unless we grab control of the steering wheel before this buggy goes off the cliff.
Well, I understand. I mean, how much, though, let me ask you this question. Historically speaking, how much power did the courts have in relation to the executive and legislative branches before the Brown decision versus after the Brown decision?
Very little. You know, it was Alexander Hamilton who famously said in Federalist Paper number 78 that the judiciary is the least dangerous and weakest branch of the federal government. And up until Brown, there had never been a decision that basically changed everybody's life. And everybody that had children in public school, which was the vast majority of Americans, particularly in 1954, was affected in their day-to-day life by the Brown decision. And you'd never seen anything like that coming from the Supreme Court or any other court in the United States prior to May 17th of 1954. Basically Hugo Black, who's one of the members of the Brown Court, said that if they pass this decision, as Justice Frankfurter, who was the primary architect of the decision, wished, they would have government by injunction. In other words, they would have to be governing every single school board in America that had a school district with a substantial minority population, telling them how much they were going to spend on school construction, telling them what they were going to do as far as, integrating the schools and whatnot. He saw it very clearly, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, Keith,
it was an unprecedented usurpation of the legislative and executive functions of government by the judiciary.
Keith, are you reading me?
I can hear you, brother.
Here's the point worth reiteration, I think, and I was making this point before we ran into the commercial break of the last segment. Again, I say, just about everything that has been that has flown against the grain, everything that has been anti-Christian, anti-American, all of the left-wing, radical, egalitarian ideas that have been put forth against this country, against its own will, have come through judicial fiat, have come through these decisions from the Supreme Court. Now, you mentioned a great litany of them, Keith. Roe versus Wade would be another one that comes to mind. The liberals know that they could have never gotten these ideas to have become accepted by the American public if it were up to the American public themselves. By ballot referendum, we still continue to shoot down gay marriage, yet it still continues to become the law of the land in state upon state. And this is the way it all started. I mean, this is how it started. It started with Brown versus Board. That's where they figured out how they could force their agenda down our throat against the will of the American people. So now I think people understand why we've been doing this segment for the last 2 weeks. This is how it all started. This is how they continue to do it. They found a winning formula. But I have to ask you, Keith, now that people have an understanding of this, what can they do to stop it? How can we take back the courts?
Well, we can take back the courts in the same way that the left took them over to begin with. We need to be very clear that the key last-ditch defense for conservatism and for traditional values in America is the Supreme Court. Right now there is a conservative majority, a very slim conservative majority, 5-4. And we need to make darn sure that we get some reliably conservative president in before one of these conservative justices die, because if the Supreme Court changes its complexion where it's 5-4 liberal as opposed to what it is now, 5-4 conservative, it's going to be Katie bar the door. We already have a Congress that is veto-proof, that has, you know, that there's no way they can prevent an override because they have 60 liberal votes in the Senate. The executive is the premier socialist Marxist in the whole history of the presidency. The only thing holding things back right now is that conservative majority in the U.S. Supreme Court. And when that goes, basically we've got liberal lunatics at the wheel of the ship of state.
Well, and then you've got the Republican Party themselves that are more interested in pandering to minorities that will never vote for them than trying to build a winning consensus. California's gone forever for the Republicans unless they put forth some sort of a massive deportation of all the illegal aliens, because these people are never going to vote for the GOP.
And of
Texas,
course, those type of things can happen. That's exactly what happened in the 1950s under Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, it could happen.
He had Operation Wetback, where he basically just rounded up illegal aliens and sent them back to their countries of origin.
Yeah, but Keith, you know, as we've already established, something like that happening in 1954, we've already gone through the realization that a lot has changed since then, and it's all been for the worse. You know, try to imagine the Republican Party of this day doing such a thing. We're going to be back with more. We'll imagine it right after this break.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, welcome back to the political cesspool, everyone. James Edwards and Bill Rowland here with you this evening, Saturday, May 16th. Keith Alexander, our correspondent, is with us for this weekly installment of Behind Enemy Lines. And we've been talking this week, as we talked last week, about the detrimental effect, detrimental to say the least, I guess that's a kind word to use in this instance, that Brown versus Board of Education has had on this country, that decision which gave the left the blueprint to bypass the will of the American people and usher in an era of cultural Marxism, the likes of which only Orwell could have foreseen back in that day and age. We know how they're doing it. This is how they have come into power. This is how they're forcing this stuff down the unwilling throats of the American people. Keith was saying it can be taken back, and it can be taken back through the courts the same way they have used our institutions against them. We can retake these institutions if we actually had a political party that was standing up for the American people and the American paleoconservative way of life. Now, the Republican Party, as I said right before that last break, they are pandering to minorities that are never going to vote for them because they are so afraid of being, they would rather lose elections, as they are beginning to do, then risk the media, who hates them already, calling them some sort of a name like a bigot. Now, if it comes to losing our way of life or having people who hate me to begin with calling me a name, I'm going to just have to suffer the name calling. But unfortunately, the Republican Party doesn't seem like they want to do that. They've already lost California. California will never vote Republican again unless they deport all of the illegal aliens. Now, Keith rightfully mentioned that that did happen in 1950, but could you imagine that happen again? That's the question I asked before the break. Texas, Florida, they are very close to being blue states because of the demographic makeover there from all of the third world people that are coming into America legally and illegally. The GOP already lost Virginia. If the GOP doesn't start standing up for their base, which is, let's face it, white middle class, blue collar voters, they'll never win again. And if they never win again, it'll be 9-0 on the Supreme Court. You'll have 9 Marxists. And that's the really bleak scenario we're looking at. So, Bill, I'll turn it over to you, and then we're going to take a caller from Pennsylvania on this subject before Keith has to leave. Bill, do you really believe that the Republican Party will ever turn itself around and stand up for the only people who have ever voted for them? Or do you think it's a lost cause politically?
The power in the Republican Party that controls the Republican Party is apparently, this power is determined to move the party further to the left. They feel that's where the greenest pastures lie, and so that is where they're going to go. And actually, I think we were making predictions about this even before the election, that the party would move further to the left. They're looking for in the ideal, you know, the ideal voter to be a homosexual who, you know, wants lower taxes.
This a black, black homosexual that wants lower taxes. And all this is indicative of their own actions of putting up a black figurehead as their chairman. I mean, come on.
Well, it's funny that they have chosen a black figurehead to run the party when it was the original Republican Abraham Lincoln who actually set this whole process into motion, not only for the Republicans, for the Democrats as well. So, you know, I mean, all you have to do is go back into history and you see the origins of all of our troubles, right? Right at the war, at the point where the country divided over crucial issues of culture and race. And, of course, from our perspective here in the South, the wrong side won and the right side lost. It's the old story of there was a phrase that was used back then, tyranny on the throne and truth on the cross. So, you know, this is the situation we're in right now. Regardless of what party you belong to, you have to face demographic realities. And the demographic reality is that none of the minorities who are voting themselves into power have the least concern for the best interests of the white majority.
Well, and then you look at it, just to add insult to injury, the few black elected officials that there are, J.C. Watts and Colin Powell, of course, Colin Powell, an elected official, he was an appointed, but, you know, they voted for Obama. So, I mean, the Republicans can't even get their own leaders to vote Republican. But anyway, before we let Keith bring this whole segment, this whole last few minutes to a conclusion, let's go to the phones very quickly. Todd in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Todd, you're on the air. Are you with us, Todd?
Yes.
All right. It's your dime, your dance floor, my friend. What do you have to say?
Oh, hi. Is this James?
It is.
Oh, hey. I've been listening to you guys for about 6 months, and I appreciate everything you do. I have a lot of respect for what you guys are doing.
Well, we have a lot of respect for our audience. Thank you very much.
Well, actually, I just wanted to say I've been listening a little bit to what you guys have been talking about today, and it just seems that the demographics in this country are so overwhelmingly going in one direction that our people, the founding stock, we probably, you know, the only way we can really keep this country would be to regroup in some place where we keep our numbers in the majority and we can decide our own destiny.
Well, you bring up a great point, Todd, and I think this is a discussion. What options do we have and which is the best course of action? This is a discussion that we've had, and we really haven't come to a consensus at all on it. Bill, I'll ask you. I mean, what do you think is the best solution here? Is it taking the long march through the institutions the way it was taken from us, try to mimic the left's tactics and retake these institutions, or some other way?
The institutions have to be bankrupt. They have to be literally starved to death. These institutions, whether it's colleges and universities or foundation grants or whatever, they do not get their money from the minorities. They don't get their money from black philanthropists. They don't get their money from Hispanic groups or philanthropists. They get their money from us, and sometimes taxpayer money as well. And so the solution here is that white people are going to have to congregate somewhere where we can express and, you know, project our political power. But right now there's no interest in that, or there's very little interest in that among whites. It is perhaps this economic crisis is going to compel white people to make some tough decisions. But
well,
clearly, the demographic change is going to take place anyway because whites are moving out of the darker areas of the country. It doesn't matter whether it's Detroit or California. They're moving out, and they've got to move somewhere.
Well, Keith,
wherever they go, it's going to be more white people.
Keith, before you comment, I want to say this. I want to thank you, Keith, for coming on again. Of course, you're on every week for the Behind Enemy Lines segment. But I want to thank you for coming forth again this year, as we do every year, and bringing this attention to the public's consciousness, the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the detrimental effects it had. I say again, you know, when people try to understand how we keep losing everything, even though everyone seemingly is in favor of our ideas, well, this is how it all started. It started the left found out they could rule from the bench, and it started with Brown. Now, yes, it can be taken back. We'll see if it actually will be, but we know what one man can do, another can do. Keith, with that being said, what say you for the final couple of minutes we have, bringing this all to a conclusion?
Well, I'd intended to talk some about how the decision was reached through the unscrupulous machinations of Felix Frankfurter, but we'll leave that for another day. We've done that if you want to check our archives in earlier shows. But to get to Todd's comment, basically we have that same fissure around now that we had back in the Civil War and before that, basically since 1820. It's called Red State, Blue State America. Now, I don't think we can initiate any type of change like that, but there are a lot of commentators, both liberal and conservative, that have predicted that America will break up like the Soviet Union broke up, like the former Yugoslavia broke up, like the United Kingdom with Scotland becoming independent, for example. And if that happens, Red State America is where people that think like us reside. Now, Bill was talking about money and how there aren't black philanthropists, but there are, unfortunately, Jewish philanthropists who are counted among us as whites, who are the primary financiers of liberalism, always have been and always will be. But in Red State America, there is not a large Jewish population. You know, in New York, there's about 10%. In a place like Tennessee, it's 0.3%. In Arkansas, in Mississippi, for example, it's 0.1%, and that's the same through a lot of Red State America. I think that Red State America is the true repository of true conservatism, and that's really, you know, if there's going to be a breakup, that's where we could be in charge of the government and have a government that reflects our vision and our values. And that's what we probably ought to be angling towards, if we're not going to take back the institutions that have basically wrought change upon the U.S. I'd rather stay a United States, but if we can't, that's the other alternative based on Todd's comments.
Well, you know, it seems to me that the Supreme Court in 1954 really adopted the role of Sanhedrin rather than the role of Supreme Court justices, and they were not operating by our system. They were operating by some Old Testament perception of themselves as being part of a holy priesthood. I think you'd agree with that, Keith.
Well, here's the thing. When they originally argued the case in December of 52, if they had taken the vote right away as they normally did, the school boards would have won against
Martin. Carve leaped to his feet and says, "Something's got a hold on me." Yow! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. Jumping pews and shouting, "Hallelujah!"
Hallelujah.
Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of the looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down.